Welcome back, Question Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know the deal by now. It's another week, another podcast. It's another time that you get to hear my voice on what I'm reading about, what I'm thinking about, what is going through my brain, and the articles that are coming across my desk. Now, this is going to be a little bit different than normal, as I'm going to really break down at least two articles that have drove me crazy. They should not change your practice. However, they are popular in the news, and I think for some people will try to change their practice based on these articles. I will tell you, the results are not what they appear to be. The outcome is not what it seems that it should be when you read the article, or at least that's my take on it. I will let you decide. And with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, Question Medicine 2019, Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's get this thing started. And a little housekeeping. Again, Andrew Bilt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. You can email me directly anytime you want. Be happy to answer any questions you have. Be happy to send over any papers that you might want to read for yourself. Unless I'm out of the country. If I'm out of the country, then it takes me a little bit longer to get you those papers or respond. But I will respond in a timely manner. And without further ado, here we go. Let's kick it off. I must confess something. See, sometimes on Question Medicine, or really just in life, I sort of feel like a broken record. I say the same things over and over and over again, hoping that someone will listen. And sometimes my wife does listen, and sometimes she doesn't listen. But either way, I keep saying the same things over and over and over again. And you see, I have said for a long time now, years, that doctors are not needed for cervical cancer or colon cancer screening. We don't need doctors for cervical or colon cancer screening. And whatever myth you want to try to portray of, well, that's the one time they come into the doctor to see me and blah, 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 that has all been debunked in the literature. The individuals that want to come to the individuals who care about their health will screen their health. And not only will they then care about the outcome because they are taking the measurements into their own hands, they usually then have a higher rate of follow-up. Again, this has been shown over and over. However, cancer screening doesn't need a doctor. And this is no more clearly seen than in this paper from JAMA, titled Effect of Mailed Human Papillomavirus Test Kits Versus Usual Care Reminders on Cervical Cancer Screening Uptake, Precancer Detection, and Treatment, a Randomized Clinical Trial. And that may sound like effect of mailed, like a male or female, but no, it's a male. Just as you think the UPS, the FedEx, a mailed HPV test versus normal care. Let's be perfectly clear. One out of every four women do not receive the recommended screening, and that is a problem. This randomized control trial included almost 20,000 women to receive either a mailed HPV test kit or to usual care reminders. You know, just the little things you get in the mail, postcards that say, you need to make an appointment, you're due for screening, or maybe it's just a phone call. You need to make an appointment, you're due for screening. And they were looking for the difference in detection and treatment of CIN 2 or higher, so CIN 2 plus, between these two groups. The inclusion criteria were women in Kaiser Permanente's Washington system that had not received a Pap test within the last 3.5 years. In the end, CIN 2 plus was detected in 12 patients in the intervention group, the male group, and 8 patients in the control group, just the usual suspects group. Now, this was not statistically different in the diagnosis and the treatment for CIN 2 plus. 8 and 12, there is really no difference there, especially when we're talking about 20,000 people that were randomized. However, the screening uptake was higher in the intervention group, 26% versus 17% in the control group, and this was statistically significant. The key deciding factor here is, if you read this paper and you're just like, well, look at that, it's not even significant, CIN2 plus is still exceedingly rare. I mean, in the real grand scheme of life, it is exceedingly rare to find a CIN2 plus. It's not impossible, but it's exceedingly rare. So I'm not surprised that a difference in screening of only 10%, basically the difference between 26% and 17%, didn't lead to a difference in the diagnosis, especially over 20,000 women. Now, if you made that over, you know, 20 million women, yeah, there would probably be a difference there. But in that sample size, I'm not surprised that there wasn't a difference. The authors say this is a negative trial. They treat this as a negative trial. However, for me, this is a win. This is proof that if we mail the screening, more women will do it. If we don't force a woman to come into the office, have time taken out of her day to make sure that she makes a just screening appointment, when realistically over 90, 95% of the tests we do are going to come back negative anyways, they are more likely to do it. The women are more likely to get screened. And after all, it is about doing the screening that the patient will actually do. Just like with colon cancer screening, we can lead a horse to water, but we can't make him drink. And with that, let's move on to the next article, which was sent to me by The Better Brain. She said, hey, will you do me a favor and look at this article? Because this article, something seems a little fishy. Something seems like a fungus among us, except it has nothing to do with yeast infections. However, this article is highly relevant for any sports medicine physician, highly relevant for any family physician, anyone who takes care of an athlete who may or may not or definitely have mono. And it is a paper titled Association of Splenic Rupture and Infectious Mononucleosis, a Retrospective Analysis and Review of Return to Play Recommendations. And before we get into all the nitty-gritty band of this detailed paper, I will tell you, in their clinical relevance, in their conclusions, they say, and I will just go ahead and quote them, restricting activity for 31 days after mononucleosis symptom onset may reduce the risk of splenic rupture. You see, right now, we hold people out for 21 days. 21 days to prevent splenic rupture. But this paper is saying, wait, maybe it's not enough. Maybe we are sending them back too soon, and we are putting these poor athletes at risk for a splenic rupture. And that is what no provider wants on their mind when they're going to sleep at night. Oh no, you do not. So let's look into this paper and see, did it say what the authors think that it said? This was a retrospective review of a large military patient database to analyze and describe the time frame of a splenic rupture with regard to infectious mononucleosis symptom onset. That part is very key. Infectious mononucleosis symptom onset. Remember that last part. Mononucleosis symptom onset. It'll be very important later, and I will come back to it. So, this patient population was anyone that had TRICARE insurance. So, this is military individuals or the families of military members. The confirmed cases of mononucleosis were defined as having a recorded time of mononucleosis onset, like symptoms, and then also having laboratory tests of either EBV or CMV infection with PCR technology. Over the course of 10 years, there was only 42 cases that fit the inclusion criteria. Out of those 42 cases, 8 of those were traumatic splenic injuries. The mean time to rupture from a traumatic injury was 23 days, with a standard deviation of basically 12 days, ranging from 1 to 40 days. So if you really want to protect every child that there is out there, then here's what you have to do. Hold them out for 40 days. Although I know if you're listening, you know that even if you send them back at 40 days, that doesn't mean that you're not going to have a rupture at 41 or 42 or 43. Holding a kid or an athlete out longer does not guarantee that there will not be any splenic ruptures, because some people just have splenic ruptures. It occurs. It is rare, but it occurs. And even in this study, when people had confirmed PCR mononucleosis over 10 years, there was only 42 cases of splenic rupture. This is an exceedingly rare thing, but holding a patient out longer doesn't mean that you're going to be able to prevent all of them. Now, all of that so far has been pretty normal, and this has been a basic paper to read. But this is when it gets crazy, so I hope you're sitting down, maybe even driving in standstill traffic so you can put this last piece all together, because this is where I think the editors and the authors really drop the ball. In the end, as the authors clearly state, 5 patients were diagnosed with mononucleosis prior to developing a symptomatic splenic injury. Basically, what they're saying is 5 patients were diagnosed with mono, then had a splenic injury. Those are the only 5 we care about, because those are the 5 we think we can help by holding them from sports, taking them out of their activities. 90% of the diagnosis of mono was diagnosed after the splenic injury. I mean, what the heck? Good goggly gook, WTF. How are we supposed to be mind readers and just know that a person has a diagnosis and is at risk for a splenic rupture? Basically, what they did was use the retrospectoscope to look at a bunch of cases where splenic rupture occurred. Then they went back and said, hey, you had symptoms of fatigue that started at this time, so maybe we could have been better off holding you out of sports during that time, so we should make a recommendation to hold people out of sports for that duration. There is multiple problems with this. One, I don't remember what I had for dinner last week, let alone exactly when my symptoms for mono started. And if you've ever had mono, and I have, sure, it is maybe a sudden onset. Maybe you do go to bed and say, I'm feeling totally fine. You wake up the next morning and you're like, man, I feel terrible. But usually, at least for my mono, it was a little bit gradual, and then all of a sudden it hit me like a ton of bricks. Well, do you do the one that hit him like a ton of bricks, or you do the one where it just started getting a little bit worse? And let's remind everyone here that these are athletes working out really hard, and the symptoms for mono are fatigue, I'm tired. Okay, well, what athlete that doesn't have a lot of hard workouts and hard training session isn't fatigued and tired? It just doesn't make sense. Finally, the retrospectoscope is always 100% correct. Always. Hindsight's 20/20, as they say. This isn't about trying to be mind readers and trying to predict who has mono without making the diagnosis and who might get a splenic rupture even though we don't have a mono diagnosis on the chart. It's about how many of these individuals had mono and then had a splenic rupture. There was 5 over 10 years. This is exceedingly rare, and we don't have an individual database that tells us of those 5, what was their breakdown to when they actually had the splenic rupture. How many days were they sitting out? And I guess I suspect it doesn't really matter, because in the end, it was 5 over 10 years. It's exceedingly rare to have this condition. Most of the time, the splenic rupture occurs, and then we make the diagnosis of mono, not the other way around. And unless we're mind readers, unless we've already had this hunch feeling that, oh, look at that athlete out there, I think that they're at risk for a splenic rupture because they have the diagnosis of mononucleosis, even though I haven't ran any PCR technology to make the diagnosis of mononucleosis, I just have this gut feeling. Unless we're supposed to be that good, then there is no way that we can say 31 days is better than 21 days, because we can never be that good. On to the next article. This is going to be the last article I do. I know it's only been 3, and I know I've dug deep into some of these articles, but I gotta get out there because they've just been building up, and I just can't do it. And I think the final straw was an article that just recently came out, fresh off the press, December 3rd, 2019. Yes, December 3rd, 2019. I'm recording this on December 5th, 2019. It is a paper titled Hair Dye and Chemical Straightener Use and Breast Cancer Risk in a Large U.S. Population of Black and White Women. Well, as the title would suggest, hair dye and chemical straighteners could be linked to breast cancer? OMG. I mean, is anything safe anymore? I don't even use toilet paper because I think it might cause anal cancer. But I digress. Here we go. Let's get into this article. This article has created so much hype and so much media attention, as you can imagine, because what are we supposed to do with the hair dyes that will be causing breast cancer? So let's put the author's opinion, or let's test the author's opinion and the media hype, and let's just look at the article. First of all, studies or outcomes of studies need to have biological plausibility, and that is particularly important for anything that uses retrospective analysis, anything that you're doing association, not causation. Sure, more popsicles are eaten during the summer and more kids drown during the summer, but does that mean that the two are connected? There's no plausibility there, so I think we can safely say, no, the one does not cause the other. So maybe women that use hair straighteners or more hair dyes are more likely to get breast cancer. What's the biological plausibility? Well, in this paper, the authors cite two other papers. One paper titled Carcinogenicity of Oxidated Product of P-phenyldiamine. I'm sure I mispronounced that. However, this is a chemical, a product, an aromatic amine, which is used in commercial hair dyes. And in this study, which the authors are citing as the biological plausibility, the phenylamine was injected into rats or applied to shaved skin of rats, painted on one time a week for 18 weeks, which is an odd ratio to have their original study say, look at this, it is possible that women will develop breast cancer, because I don't know any woman, A, that paints on this chemical one time a week for 18 weeks consecutively. I mean, I know women that dye their hair, but not every single week. And most importantly, I don't know any woman that shaves her head and then paints it on her bare scalp. She puts it into the hair that is on her head, not into the bare scalp that's freshly shaven. And I don't know any woman that injects hair dye into her bloodstream. But again, I digress. This is the article that they're saying, well, look, there's the biological plausibility. And I grant you, there was an increase in mammary gland cancer in the shaved skin rats and an increase in mammary, uterus, and soft tissue tumors for the injection rats. They also cite another paper titled 2,4-diaminoansyl sulfate, early effect on thyroid gland morphology and late effect on glandular tissue of Fisher 344 rats. And for that paper, they had the rats eat this diaminosyl sulfate, which is a hair dye component. It is in hair products. However, they had the rats eat it. I don't know any woman that is dyeing her hair and then saying, oh yeah, and let me eat some of this at the same time. Let me dye some hair, let me eat some of this. And they did it for 86 weeks. And I grant you, there was an increase in tumors. Yep, it happened, no doubt. But the biological plausibility that we can inject rats with a chemical that's in hair dyes, or we can feed rats the chemical that's in hair dyes, and make that leap to, well, look at that, it must be that then the hair dyes are causing breast cancer, seems like a bit of a stretch to me. But let's carry on to the original paper. They asked 46,000 women who had sisters with breast cancer, but were breast cancer free themselves, to fill out a survey at baseline, and then again every 2 to 3 years. And this was not any ordinary survey, mind you. No. The survey was more than a survey. It was an interview for a high-trained job, like the President of the United States. It was a 2-hour phone interview that they had to complete. And then every 2 to 3 years, the women were asked to complete a 2 to 3 page booklet of 20 to 30 pages long. Let's say a random booklet has, I don't know, 5 to 10 questions. There's 200 questions per booklet. There's 2 to 3 booklets. So again, on the very low end, there's a minimum of 400 different questions that they're asking. And I'm guessing it's way more than that. And this is where I could go on a rant that says the p-value is 0.05, which means if you test for 100 things, you will find at least 5 things that are false positives, if you will. You will find 5 things that you weren't expecting to find and you shouldn't have found because they're not actually real. It's white noise in the background. That's what the p-value of 0.05 means. And if you wanted a p-value of 0.010, so 10, then for every 100, you'd have 10 that are off. And if you had a p-value, if you wanted a p-value of, I don't know, 0.5, it means 50 of them would be false findings or false positives. They then use hazard ratios and they turn the association between hair products and breast cancer and the permanent dye use was associated. Here it is, was associated with a 45% higher breast cancer risk in black women only. Because as I'm sure you know, the 7% higher risk in white women, well, that was not statistically significant. So really, it's only significant in African American population. There is something about the hair dye that makes cancers occur that must only affect African-American women. Seems a little fishy if you ask me. And when you go and look at the personal straightener use, among all the participants with personal straightener use, there was an association with breast cancer that was not statistically significant. Confidence intervals 0.99 to 1.41. Yes, it might trend towards significant, but let me tell you, that's not significant. And they tested for hundreds of things. They don't tell me exactly how many things they had. I even went into the details, into the supplemental data. They don't tell you how many things they were asking. But really, all they can find out, all that is permanent hair dyes has an increased risk of breast cancer among black women. And the biological plausibility is based on rat studies, which they fed the rats hair dye chemical compounds. They injected the rats with hair dye chemical compounds, or they shaved the rats and then painted hair dye chemical compounds on the rats. And I don't know any woman, black, white, Indian, Asian, Caucasian, you name it, that does any of those things. It just doesn't make sense. This is a terrible article, but I know it's going to get so much media press. So hopefully we can stop this rumor before it spreads halfway around the world. And that, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, wraps up this very short number of articles that I'm going to talk about today. I'll be back next week. I'll try to hit more articles next week. So let's end this podcast as we've ended every one before it. If you mail a woman an HPV test opposed to just doing normal, calling her, sending her a note card, she is more likely to get cervical cancer screening when you mail her the test. If you make it easier on the patient, they will more likely do what you want them to do. What a coincidence. As the new conference season comes among us, you may hear some individuals saying, well, there was a new article out there saying that 31 days taking a patient or an athlete out of sports for mononucleosis actually prevents their splenic rupture. But you know the real deal. These was retrospectoscope splenic ruptures. They were looking at splenic ruptures and then making the diagnosis of mono, not making the diagnosis of mono and then holding the patient out and then having a splenic rupture. Those are two totally different things. You cannot cross-correlate those. 21 days, stick to it. It's the best we got. And again, in the grand scheme of things, this is a relatively rare event. Is it going to occur? Yeah, probably. Is it going to occur a lot? No, it can't. It can't occur a lot. It's just a rare thing. It happens even when you do the very best. Sometimes things just happen. And last but not least, what about hair dyes? What about straighteners? Do they cause breast cancer? If you look at this one paper that just came out that's causing all the media hype, well then, yes, there is an increased risk of breast cancer in African-American women who use hair dyes. If you use any kind of logic whatsoever and you actually break down the study, well then, no, absolutely not. Hair dyes do not cause breast cancer. There's no biological plausibility here. The numbers are skewed. They looked at all kinds of different endpoints. You just can't do any of that. There's so many flaws in this. And that will wrap this up. So, here we go. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.